This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. 1 year ago, a white supremacist shooter killed 23 Mexicans and Mexican-Americans at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas. A dozen people were injured. Today's guest, Alfredo Corchado, interviewed family members of those who were killed, witnesses, and multiple sources close to the investigation. He also reviewed hundreds of pages of documents related to the massacre. Alfredo Corchado is Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, where he covers U.S. policy in Latin America. He is the author of Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey, which chronicles his experiences covering the drug war in Mexico. His most recent book is Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. Hi, Alfredo. Thank you so much for joining us. Nice to have you back. Hi, do we have Alfredo? Oh, looks like he was disconnected. Well, we will connect with him in just a couple of minutes. I hope you can take some time to read Alfredo's pieces because he, like I said, he's been interviewing loved ones of people who were shot and killed. And I mean, as you know, this was so, so devastating. Earlier this year, the Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks white nationalism, white supremacy, and hate groups, identified 155 white nationalist groups in the United States last year. That is up from 148 in 2018 and a 55% increase since 2017. And then, of course, what we've seen coming out of the Trump White House, he's been very consistent in his racist, anti-immigrant, and xenophobic rhetoric. I think we have Alfredo back. Are you with us, Alfredo?
Thank you for having me again.
Well, it's great to have you back, Alfredo. Thank you so much for joining us. You interviewed family members of those who were killed. You interviewed witnesses, multiple sources close to the investigation. Before we get into what you found, what do you think are some of the lessons that should have been learned from the carnage, especially for the media? What really stands out for you?
What stands out for me is how rhetoric, hateful language, can really play a role that leads to tragic circumstances. I mean, one thing that stuck out with me as I was reporting the story 1 year later was how many of the victims thought that the rest of the country would have learned something from what happened in El Paso, that language really does matter, that when you call people, when you dehumanize human beings, immigrants, you call them criminals, invaders and infestations, that really has consequences. And a year later, this country is so divided. You have racial conflict, you have the George Floyd. And so one thing that just struck at me was how victim after victim after victim said, I really thought I lost my loved one, I lost my son, I lost my mother. I would have thought we would have been in a better place today, and we're not.
I mean, I hate saying this, Alfredo, but the fact of the matter is, Trump started his campaign by saying, Mexicans are rapists. I hate saying that, but this came from his mouth, and it's important for us to really draw those connections as you did. So over the last year, we just, we're hearing more and more from him. And now, of course, he's really saying horrific things about the coronavirus and Asians, and we're seeing an uptick of violence against Asians. How do you think the media are dealing with this kind of hate speech, and how should they deal with it?
Well, I think, there's two options. I mean, we debate this a lot. One of the more interesting debates as we were writing this story was, to what extent do we make it about the shooter and about his, some people call it a manifesto. I mean, I think we end up calling it a creed, or I personally refer to it as a rant. I mean, how much publicity do you give that? Because after all, it comes down to the victims. I mean, this is a story about victims who are left to deal not just with the loss of a loved one, but it's going to be, El Paso, the victims, it's a wound that won't heal anytime soon. So I think as media members, we have to try to stay as much away from inflaming those words even more. because there are a lot of people who are going to take those messages as a green light to further cause more damage, I mean, and further divide the country, and use hate as a way to do this. I mean, it's not just white supremacists or white nationalists, but I think there's a lot of hate in this country. There's a lot of prejudice in this country. As the demographics change so much, there's growing prejudice and a sense of we against the others, you know. I think, if anything, this pandemic has forced America to deal with its own hypocrisy. I mean, the people who are out there working their butts off, whether it's the housing industry, the agriculture fields, the meat plants, the poultry industry, the people who are putting food on the table of millions of Americans are workers, many of them, many, as much as 70% just in the agricultural industry, are people without documents. But I don't see a line of Americans waiting to take these jobs that, you know, pay anywhere. I was talking to a grower. He says, we've had to raise wages up to more than $20 because we can't find Americans, and because farm workers are aging, and all they want to do is go back to Mexico. I mean, it's a reality I think this country has to come to grips with. It's a double speak. It's in many ways a hypocrisy.
Right, exactly. And we'll talk about this later, but when you look at the COVID numbers in so many states across the country, Latinos are disproportionately getting sick and disproportionately dying.
I think by three times.
Yeah. Well, as you said, Alfredo, it's so difficult with someone like Trump because the rhetoric is just so brutal and so hateful. But as you said, it's so important for the stories of the people not to get lost. So you and your colleagues did tell the stories of survivors. And let's just talk about a few. You write about Will Anglesby. Is that right? Anglesby? His father, Richard, was from Louisiana. He met Angelia Maria Silva in high school in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The high school sweethearts married. They had seven children. Will is the eldest. They moved to El Paso in 1968. So tell us more about this family.
This is a family that in many ways encapsulates not just the border, but, you know, the country. I mean, the mixes that we have with their own families. I mean, Angelina, from what Will talked to us about, you know, was a very strong, very determined person. She was strong in the sense that she was very proud of her culture. She was very proud of her past, and spoke Spanish, tried to get her children to really embrace both sides of them, you know, become binational, bilingual, bicultural. And Will said, you know, in school, he had a hard time because he's fair-skinned. He's got light hazel eyes. And people will look at him as American. And he said, you know, it was hard for me to say, hey, I'm also Hispanic. It just didn't happen. But after his mother died that tragic morning of August 3rd inside Walmart, he said, you know, I appreciate more than ever what my mother tried to bring to us. And in the interview, I think one of the most poignant moments in the interview was when he referred to the shooter and he said, my mother was more American than you, idiot. I mean, it's a very powerful moment. Will works at a sports bar in El Paso. It was infected by COVID-19. But after that, you know, I said, Will, I really want to talk to you one more time. He says, if you want to talk to me, come to the cemetery. I go every other day to talk to my mother. Mm. And it was, you know, it was a very powerful moment. But I asked Will that day, I said, what do you want people to know? He says, you know, I come here and I talk to my mother and I tell her we'll soon be together. I'm 58 and 59. It won't be long. We'll be together again. It just, you know, in those words, I mean, he talks about his own struggle, a day-to-day struggle to deal with this. Obviously, these people's lives will never be the same. I mean, they'll never have that loved one in their lives. And that's something that we wanted to make sure that that came across. You know, the fact that these victims trusted us with their stories. We wanted to do justice to the story and not make it so much about the shooter. Obviously, the shooter had to play a role. We tried to talk to his family. They've lawyered up. It was next to impossible, but we did get to visit the grandfather, which is the last house where the shooter once lived in North Texas.
Just one more comment about Will. You write, Will thinks about the gunman's rant about the need to stop the, quote, Hispanic invasion in lands that once belonged to Mexico and before that Spain.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's so powerful because that was the gunman's, one of his allegations in his rant was to come and kick the invaders out. Basically, what he was saying, you know, is I'm going to erase their history. I'm going to make them invisible. Well, how the hell do you do that when these lands once belonged to Mexico and they belonged to Spain? And even now, yes, we're two different countries, but the demographics are such that it's still very much a largely Mexican-American population, very proud of their American, the Americans in them, but also very proud of the roots that comes back through, you know, histories of families. It's a complex situation, but that's where these stories, I think, really shine when you get to the complexity of the region and of the border and of the people themselves who are very complex figures in the whole piece.
Right. Well, and then Will visiting his mom's grave several times a week. It just makes us think about how the news is just moving so fast, Alfredo, and with COVID, it's almost like the long-term suffering of these survivors is forgotten until there's an anniversary and until you and your colleagues write about what they're going through.
Well, I'm going to tell you something about journalism. I mean, we speak a lot about the importance of diversity in newsrooms. But when this hit, August the 3rd, the three reporters who cover this happened to be Mexican-Americans. Mm. And we made a vow then that we were not going to let this be forgotten, that we were going to push for it and push for it, and not just do, you know, the daily stories that you have to cover, but we were going to do a long piece as to what actually happened inside that Walmart, outside that Walmart, and what's happened to the people since then. We've been committed. I mean, it's been a bond and a promise that we've made to each other. And even now, I mean, we remain committed to covering the story as long as it takes. And with COVID, you're right. It's going to, the whole process will probably be slowed down. You know, the process to seek justice may take a year, it may take two, it may take more. But we're going to continue covering this because it is an important story, not just for El Paso. I mean, I think that's one of the other problems we make as journalists, you know. It becomes a local story, it becomes a regional story. No, this is not a local. It's not regional. And I wish there would have been more national media covering this. Maybe because of COVID, you know, it didn't happen. But I think it's such an important story. It's the largest attack against Latinos in modern history. And it has to be covered by everyone.
And the details are just so brutal. I mean, you writing about the shooter just walking around the store and hunting people down. Honestly, Alfredo, we've been so bogged down in the show that I haven't noticed the national media attention of the shooting, but it just didn't get much attention. Is that what you're saying?
It didn't get much attention at all. I expected to see my colleagues from the New York Times or the Washington Post or others, you know, to either come to El Paso or if it's COVID, at least write about the story.
Hmm.
I think it says a lot about, I mean, you hit it right on the nail. It says a lot about the whole immigration debate, the whole immigration strategy that a Donald Trump with his architect, Stephen Miller, have crafted and the ramifications of that policy. I mean, it's been walls. It's been the cry, chants, you know, build a wall, finish the wall. Let's stop the invasion. It's led groups, private groups, to build their own fences and to try to get more Americans to chip in because they are losing control of the border. BS. You come to the border, and yes, there are problems in Mexico. You can't deny that, but we live in some of the safest communities in this country.
How do you deal with this, Alfredo? Because we struggle with this also. We're the kind of show that wants to go on the ground and talk to the people. What's going on? What are they facing? What are their challenges? You know, what are people doing to make things better? At the same time, we need to also let people know what's happening in this administration. You know, who is Stephen Miller? What is his plan? What if they get another 4 years? So we have to do both, and it's a really difficult one. How do you deal with that?
You have to try. I mean, you get into journalism to try to hold people accountable, to try to keep writing about these stories and make sure that there's some kind of accountability. And it's never been more important than it is today to, you know, to hold these words, to listen to these words and say, is that really what's happening? And then keep writing about it and keep writing about it. It's a very different time for journalists. I mean, I keep saying that. I sound like a broken record, but I can't think of a more important time than today to be a journalist and to hold everything they say, whether it's Homeland Security, ICE, you know, what they're doing on the border, the tactics they use in the border, they're not being used in Portland. They're not being used in New York City and other cities. I mean, we have to hold them accountable as much as we can, and we just keep repeating and repeating. Yes, there's always a backlash. You're liberal media, you know, especially if you're Hispanic. I mean, you're gonna get cream. The liberal media with the Hispanic agenda. Well, Jesus Christ, the Southwest is mostly Hispanic.
Right.
You know, I mean, we have to write about these stories because they, again, have real consequences on our daily lives.
Yeah, exactly. And you reminded me, Alfredo, undocumented immigrants have not had access to any unemployment. We are now in August. This COVID is, there's no end in sight at this point. Here in California, undocumented immigrants have only had access to a mere $500. I mean, people are really, really suffering. What's it been like for people in your undocumented immigrants in your area?
Oh, it's been the same. I mean, we hear the same stories. And one of the stories that doesn't get much attention on the border is that we have hundreds, if not, you know, thousands of people on the Mexican side, gardeners and people who come and take care of children, take care of homes, and et cetera. They've not been able to cross the border in over 5 months. Mexico's lost 10 million jobs. And these people are without work. I mean, there's a real, I mean, we focus so much on the United States, but Mexico is going through an incredibly difficult time with the drug war. The COVID deaths are now over 50,000. The drug war, they think it's going to hit more than 35,000 this year. It'll probably hit 40,000 the way the numbers are going. So you see what's happening in Mexico, and you look at long term, I mean, You're already seeing more of a push of Mexicans trying to cross the border because the situation in Mexico is so bad. Why is that significant? Because we haven't seen a push since 2007, and that just tells you the kind of situation Mexico is. One thing that the Mexican ambassador said yesterday during a talk, I was really surprised at this number. She said more than 2,000 Mexicans have died in the United States because of COVID. These are people in the front lines, whether they're farm workers, whether they're in the poultry industry, the service industry. But I thought that number was really interesting. More than 2,000 people have died already.
Wow. Today we are speaking with Alfredo Corchado, Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, where he covers U.S. policy and Latin America. Alfredo, I also wanted to ask you about the recent interview that you and a few colleagues and reporters did. You interviewed Joe Biden over Zoom. You talked about a number of issues. What really stood out for you about Biden's immigration and wall policy?
Well, this was an interview of four journalists, four members of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists and National Association of Black Journalists. It's an invitation that goes out every 4 years to the presidential candidates. Trump was invited. He he never officially declined, but we never really heard back from him to do the interview. So I want to make sure that, you know, we try to get both sides. Biden was the only one to confirm. I think the main takeaway that I took out of the interview was that essentially he said, if elected, I'm going to dismantle Trump's immigration policy. I'm going to hold ICE accountable. I'm going to hold Homeland Security accountable. I'm going to send ICE back to school. I'm going to end Remain in Mexico, and I won't build another foot of wall between the United States and Mexico. I mean, bam, bam, bam. You know, those have been the pillars of the Trump administration. And we asked him, you know, how do you do that? I mean, how do you go back to a pre-Trump era when it comes to border security? He says, I'm going to focus on technology and try to do a virtual wall or use, you know, a virtual wall that's already in some parts of the border, number one. Number two, I know the Senate. I can work with the Senate, and I can get an immigration bill to pass. He said he had already written a bill to legalize millions of undocumented immigrants led by DACA. It's pretty ambitious. I think we heard it from Obama. I hope, and a lot of people I talked to said, you know, let's hope this is not more rhetoric to get elected. But the fact that he said it, I thought was interesting. And the fact that he just kind of went to every Trump policy, whether it's keeping families across the border, whether it's having third world countries to just send people across to wait and wait and wait in some of the most dangerous areas of Mexico, I thought it was significant.
What about a path to citizenship for other undocumented immigrants?
He said he was committed, and I guess he stressed the word that his bill is, quote, already written, and that he would send that along to Congress on his first day in office as president. And you know, he went beyond DACA. He talked about the 11 million in this country who live and work without documents. He said it was quote outrageous what ICE does. You know, they detain people outside churches, outside courthouses, outside schools. He said we're not going to do that again.
And we do know, I mean, the Biden-Obama administration, or Obama-Biden, I should say, got a lot of criticism from Latinos for deporting so many people. Were you able to ask him about that?
Yeah, we asked him that question. We asked him the question. He said, you know, President Obama was known as the deporter-in-chief. He sent more than 3 million immigrants, and he reiterated that he was serious about legalizing. There was a sense in talking to some of his people afterwards, that they realized that strategy of trying to appease the Republicans to get something, a comprehensive bill passed, an immigration bill, didn't work. Hmm. But again, these are politicians, these are campaigns. It's up to the voters to, you know, really decide what they want America to be.
Right. Alfredo Quezada.
Is it too late to even retake this country? That's really the question.
Well, that is another question. And that's why the media are so important, to ask these important questions. Alfredo Corchado is Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, where he covers U.S. policy in Latin America. His most recent book is Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. And I hope you can take some time to read the piece that Alfredo wrote with two colleagues called Every Day is a Struggle, El Paso, One Year Later. Alfredo, as always, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to have you. Thank you. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for running our studio. And just to give you a quick update, it looks like there still is no plan on unemployment benefits. The Democrats are pushing Republicans to agree to extend the $600 in weekly unemployment benefits. So far, nothing has happened, and so we will continue to stay on top of this issue. You can listen to past shows and podcast our show at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.